Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Growing up in China during the Cultural Revolution, writer Ha Jin first heard the Nanjing Massacre, but he did not become aware of the heroic role some Westerners played until he read Iris Chang's book, The Rape of Nanjing. His latest novel centers on Minnie Votrin, an American missionary who saved thousands of Chinese lives. In an introductory letter, Ha Jin writes, "She suffered and ruined herself by helping others, but she became a legend. At least her story has moved me to write a novel about her. If I succeed, my book might put her soul in peace." The title of the book is Nanjing Requiem, and Ha Jin joins me in the studio. He is professor of English at Boston University. His previous books include Waiting, which won the Penn Faulkner Award, the National Book Award, War Trash, which won the Penn Faulkner Award, and then Story Collections, Under the Red Flag, which won the Flannery O'Connor Award for Short Fiction, and Ocean of Words, which won the Penn Hemingway Award. You are certainly an award-winning writer, Ha Jin. It's so good to see you.
Thank you. Very happy to be here.
I was interested in the fact that you gave up writing this book twice.
Yes.
Why?
Because, largely because the protagonist, Minnie Votrin, was a historical figure. So, and I couldn't invent any happenings for her as a character. And during the massacre, in the first 6 weeks, it was very tense. A lot of drama was going on. But afterwards, she stayed in China for 2.5 years more. And there were no major big events that happened to herself. So I couldn't create any events like that. Then the question would be, how can I come up with enough narrative drive for the novel? So in fact, I revised many, many times. I think at 32 revisions, I sent the manuscript to my editor, and the book didn't gel. It didn't hang together. All the details were there and interesting, but the novel somehow was not unified because of that. I couldn't invent anything for her.
Tell me about growing up in China. What did you know about that war between China and Japan at the time?
And everything was quite vague. I remember we were brought to some mines in former Manchuria and the northeast part of China. And we were shown a lot of bones because the Japanese used a lot of miners and to get coal. And so a lot of people died in those mines. But other than that, I really didn't have a kind of any concrete picture of the war. And I heard of a Nanjing massacre, but I didn't know any detail at all.
Until you read Iris Chang's book.
Yes, that was part a major step. Before that, in fact, outside China, Chinese Americans had always kept that kind of memory alive. And they would hold gatherings, meetings in memory of the atrocities and every year. So that was a surprise for me when I had come to the States. And then in 1997, Iris Chang's book came out. And then at that point, I began to know there were foreigners' involvement in the tragedy. But before that, I never heard of anything. I had never heard of anything about the Westerners' involvement.
But in addition to the Westerners' involvement, were you stunned? Were you shocked? Were you absolutely abhorring the tragedy as it was written about, and wondering how could this have happened?
Yes, I was very shocked, in fact, because of the meetings and the gatherings at those events, there were exhibits of photographs and the graphics, also a lot of written materials. And that was the first time I came to see these things. So that's why I was very, very shocked.
The opening paragraph of the book draws us in absolutely immediately. You write, "Finally, Ben began to talk. For a whole evening, we sat in the dining room listening to the boy." He said, "That afternoon when Principal Votrin told me to go to Mr. Rabe about the random arrest in our camp, I ran to the Safety Zone Committee's headquarters. As I was reaching that house, two Japanese soldiers stopped me, one pointing his bayonet at my tummy and the other sticking his gun against my back. They ripped off my Red Cross armband and hit me in the face with their fists. Then they took me away to White Cloud Shrine. There's a pond inside the temple, and a lot of carp and bass lived in the water. The monks were all gone, except for two old ones who'd been shot dead and dumped into a latrine. The Japanese wanted to catch the fish, but didn't have a net. An officer emptied his pistol into the pond, but didn't hit any fish. Then another one began throwing grenades into the water. In a flash, big bass and carp surfaced, all knocked out and belly up. The Japs poked us four Chinese with bayonets and ordered us to undress and get into the water to bring out the fish. I couldn't swim and was scared, but I had to jump into the pond. The water was freezing cold. Luckily, it was just waist deep. We brought all the half-dead fish to the bank, and the Japanese smashed their heads with rifle butts, strung them through the gills with hemp ropes, and tied them to shoulder poles. Together, we carried the fish to their billets. They were large fish, each wing at least 15 pounds. That's how Ha Jin opens his new novel, Nanjing Requiem. If you'd like to join us, call us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Why did you, Ha Jin, decide to focus on Minnie Votrin's story?
I was so shocked when I saw those photographs at the gatherings, and I began to figure how to write about this tragedy.
Describe photographs.
For instance, there are, like the passage you just read, the soldiers carry big fish. You know, they caught a lot of big fish from apparently from some Chinese farmers, and they were very happy. And at the same time, there were a lot of women. They were, in fact, their photographs were kept by the soldiers. Those photographs were taken, eventually taken from the Japanese soldiers. And when they were captured, and the women were naked. Apparently, some of them were crying. And there are many other, like in a pond. The pond was stuffed with dead bodies everywhere. And so a lot of bloody photographs.
The women had been taken and raped.
Yes.
And then killed.
Yes, yes.
Many of them.
And mutilated. Their bodies, I think that the most horrifying part was the bodies were mutilated.
What else besides those photographs did you rely on to create this historical novel?
A lot of written materials. And in fact, I give a list at the back of the novel. And in fact, there were sources. The Japanese, they had done a lot of work in this area. And there were publications of their soldiers' diaries, interviews. And so they were very reliable in a way. For instance, a lot of details I just... Most of the details were not imagined at all. They were picked from different written records, and some of them are just directly from the soldiers' diaries.
Hajin, his new novel is titled Nanjing Requiem. We'll take a short break here. When we come back, more about the novel and your calls. And welcome back. The writer and professor of English at Boston University, Hajin, is with me. His latest novel, titled Nanjing Requiem. And it is truly a story that you focused on Minnie Votren. Tell
yes.
us about her.
She grew up in a small town called Secker, Illinois, in a very poor family, from a very poor family. At a very early age, I think 6, she began to keep house for her father. And later, at the graduation of college from the University of Illinois, she was somehow noticed by some missionaries who had returned from China. She was persuaded to go to China to educate the Chinese girls. So that's how she started her mission as a Christian. And she lived in Hebei and started a girls' school. I think she worked there almost about a decade. Then she moved to Nanjing and to serve as the dean of the Jinling Women's College. That's how she became a leader, a well-known figure in the city. And then the Japanese invasion took place in 1937. She was instructed to stay behind to take care of the campus. But that campus was used later, was used as a refugee camp. And she basically did everything, tried to help the women and the children. And she suffered a lot. In fact, she was traumatized by it. And eventually she had a breakdown. It just couldn't continue anymore. She returned to the States and for treatment. But that didn't work well. So eventually she took her own life.
How many people, women, girls, others, did she attempt to house at the women's college?
At the peak, I think it reached 12,000 at the peak.
12,000?
Yes. Originally, they had planned just for 2,000 because they measured, I think, 16 square feet per person. But there were so many refugees, there was no way for them to reject them. So they just took everybody. So at the peak, they lost the count. But it was about 12,000 at the peak.
The cruelty of the Japanese during that period is really recreated in your book, in the sense that there are some scenes that are difficult to read, and you wrote in a woman's voice.
Yes, in fact, that was a change. In the beginning, I just wrote in the third-person narrative, but from Minnie Watson's point of view. But
it didn't work.
So I had to change the structure drastically. And invented a Chinese woman who was her assistant to let her tell Minnie Watson's story. Also, and at some point, she can tell her own story, because I think the book needs some that part, because the Chinese were the real victims. They took the brunt of the violence. So it was necessary to have the narrator's story. But she was a supporting character.
Was Minnie Votren herself not in danger because she was an American?
I think on the whole, yes. But she was slapped and punched frequently. In her diary, that was recorded. I often got slapped by the soldiers. But the Japanese soldiers.
We've had a few emailers saying, in effect, the most horrendous thing about what happened in Nanking, he says, during the massacre, is that the Japanese have yet to acknowledge their involvement in it.
I think there has been discussion, and many scholars, they admitted that this had happened. And as I mentioned just now, the Japanese had done a lot of work, the soldiers' diaries and interviews, and even Minnie Watson's diary was published long ago in Japanese. So there are Japanese and Japanese. There are right-wing elements. So sure, there is even a school called a fictional school. That means the whole event was purely created fiction. But on the other hand, there are a lot of Japanese who felt very guilty about this. I think the fact was at the Tokyo International Trial, that was already concluded. More than 200,000 Chinese were killed in the city. So there was no dispute about that fact at all.
So there was literally an attempt to wipe out Nanjing?
I think there it might not have been planned. But suddenly the soldiers, once they entered the city, all the rules collapsed, and all the evil was unleashed. So there was no way to control the soldiers.
Give me a sense of what you read from some of the Japanese soldiers' diaries.
For instance, in the beginning, there are a few details. And the boy said, Ben said, there was so much killing that they couldn't find clean water to drink.
There was blood flowing in the water.
Yeah, and because all the cooked rice were red, it was red, but that was recorded by the Japanese. So that was in a diary, in a soldier's diary.
Did any of the Japanese soldiers express regret?
Yes, yes. And there are, in fact, some older soldiers, veterans, not many, but some, they would go to Nanjing and to face the museum of the massacre to express their regret.
Tell me why you focused this on the Jinling Women's College. Was it truly the Wellesley of China?
In fact, it was intended, yes. And it was a sister school for Smith College. And really, it was an American school, American Women's College. So I think that's why I decided on this school as a setting, because partly this was also an American experience. These missionaries, they are part of the tragedy. Many of them were traumatized, troubled, and mentally disturbed later on. And at the Tokyo trial, because the American missionaries had kept a lot of evidence, written records, photographs, even film footage. And so the court could decide on the scale and the magnitude of the tragedy. The Chinese hadn't collected much evidence at all, because when they were fighting, they couldn't imagine someday they would try these war criminals. So really, this event, this tragedy, was part of American experience as well.
And as you say, Minnie Votrin came back here to the States extraordinarily upset.
Yes.
Extraordinarily troubled. Mm-hmm. And she finally took her own life because she felt she had not done enough.
Yes, I think that was the part, because she belonged to the church. She was not supposed to kill herself, so she couldn't be held up as a model. But to my mind, also to a lot of local Chinese, she was a hero. She really was a hero. And I think briefly after the massacre, she was known as a goddess of mercy. But when the communists came to power, her name was suppressed in the media. As a result, when I grew up, I never heard of any of the Americans' involvement at all.
No American
involvement. No, only the negative part, how Americans have the Japanese. Only the negative.
Tell me how she managed with that many people. How did she manage to get food in? How did she manage toilet facilities?
Yes,
what did they do?
I know. See, that's why I said it was part of American experience. Because, for instance, let's just take food, for example. No Chinese could transport the food at all, because if the Chinese drove a car and the Japanese would take it away. So only foreigners could drive. As a result, the missionaries, a few of them, like Cyril Bates, Louis Smythe, Plumer Mills, and many of them, they drove and to deliver grain and fuel. They had to use coal and wood to cook the rice. So the basic work was done by missionaries. And just imagine, in fact, the zones called Nanjing International Security Zone, that sheltered a quarter of a million civilians. Imagine just that work, just to provide food and fuel, not to mention the facilities for, you know, the other kind of sanitary maintenance. It was an enormous amount of work, and huge amount. It's unimaginable.
I can't imagine how they did it.
I think I read some small memoirs written by some of the victims, they said Minnie Watson was extremely efficient in maintaining order. Everything somehow was planned very carefully on the campus. And apparently, these missionaries, they were very efficient. They worked very hard, too.
I want to go back to An Ling, the young woman who was the fictional assistant to Minnie Votrin. You created her, and you wrote in her voice.
Yes.
How difficult was that for you?
That part was not that difficult, because after that, in fact, when the manuscript was returned because it didn't work, I told my editor that give me 2 more years and I'll try to finish it. But once I started, everything just came together very rapidly.
When you began to write
the
first person.
Yes.
Were you thinking in Chinese and writing in English? What was happening?
In English. But what happened was, everything, I had already absorbed everything inside, in me. So everything just came out. So I realized that all the mistakes and the wrong turns had been homework. So everything came together very rapidly. I finished the book in 4 months. But before that, of course, a lot of labor just to find the material, the details, the right details.
Ha Xin, and we're talking about his newest novel, titled Nanjing Requiem, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. I'm going to open the phones. We have a caller in Dallas, Texas. Good morning, David. Thanks for waiting.
Good morning, Diane. I learn so much from your show every morning. Thank you for everything that you do.
Oh, you're most welcome. Thank you.
And thank you, Ha Xin, for your book. I'm originally from New Zealand, and I went to Nanjing about 10 years ago. And there I went to the Nanjing Holocaust Museum, and I learned about the rape of Nanjing for the first time. I'd never been exposed to anything like that before, and it was a very powerful experience and an incredible way to learn about that event. Now, I just think it's a shame that there's such a lack of education in the Western world about this event, and so I thank you for your contribution, and I would encourage everybody to read and learn about what happened in this incredible chapter in Chinese history.
Thank you, David.
Oh, thank you very much, David. And in fact, that, as I said just now, this was really an international experience, not only the Chinese. And there were Germans, even a Russian man in the who try to help the Chinese. And I think really we should, that's why I want to write this book from an American woman's point of view and to put this event in the context of the international context.
What were the events that led up to the rape of Nanjing?
Before that, there was a attack on Shanghai. The Japanese had planned to take the city in a week or two. But the battle lasted more than 3 months, and they suffered heavy casualties.
The Japanese
And they didn't expect the Chinese would be so stubborn. And so that was the immediate event. The Chinese retreated, but earned time for further battles. And the Japanese really intended to proceed to seize the capital of China, also to teach a lesson, very bloody lesson, to intimidate, to frighten the Chinese, to make them surrender. So that was the intention at the time.
Could the rape of Nanjing have been avoided?
Yes, I think that was the part of the Chinese part. They made a mistake. The nationalist government, they should not have put up a defense there. The geographically, that city was very, very difficult to defend. All Chiang Kai-shek's German advisors urged him not to do that. Some Chinese generals were also opposed to the plan. But somehow they put up a defense, build defense work around the city and inside the city. As a result, a lot of civilians were killed, wiped out.
So do you believe it was Chiang Kai-shek's mistake? Was it the general's mistake? What was it?
For the first thing is the Japanese, because of the invasion.
That was not justified.
That was a part of it. Also, the Japanese troops were not well supplied. They were instructed to leave off the land. But imagine if you took everything from the civilians, how could you control the men? And so as a result, all the violence was unleashed. And basically, they killed and burned all the way to Nanjing.
Hai Jin, and we're talking about his new novel, Nanjing Requiem. When we come back, your calls, email, I look forward to hearing from you.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. By American Jewish World Service, pursuing global justice through grassroots change at ajws.org. And by the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting solutions to prevent and end homelessness on the web at melvilletrust.org. This is NPR.
David Coleman Headley was one of the leaders of the terrorist attack on Mumbai. The son of a Pakistani father and American mother, Headley became a drug smuggler, then a DEA informant, and after 9/11, an Islamic militant while working for the DEA. On the next Fresh Air, we speak with investigative reporter Sebastian Rotella about his new Frontline documentary. Join us.
If you just joined us, the wonderful writer, award-winning writer, Hai Jin, is with me. His latest novel, titled Nanjing Requiem, all about the invasion in 1937 of Nanjing by the Japanese, the slaughter that took place, the refuge that many thousands of Chinese took at the American Women's College in Nanjing. Here's an email from Matthew, who says, wasn't there a Nazi German there who was helping the refugees?
Yes, his name was John Rabe. And he was the local Nazi leader in Nanjing. But he was a businessman for the company, a German company, businessman. And he was loved by the local Chinese. He opened his house. He used his house to shelter a lot of civilians. And he was also the head of all the foreigners, the safety zone committee. And the Nanjing, the Chinese mayor had escaped. And so as a result, John Rabe was called the mayor by the Chinese.
So the mayor had actually escaped.
Yeah, the real mayor escaped.
And John Rabe became
a mayor. But it was a nickname, but he wouldn't let the Chinese to call him because he wouldn't offend the puppet municipality. So, but in private, most people refer to him as the mayor.
Did he and Minnie Votren collaborate in trying to help these people?
Yes, but he was very active, but he stayed in Nanjing 2 months after the Matagaki left. So the work was left for the Americans to do. All the American missionaries stayed for another 2 years. So John Rabe, initially he was very, very active, but he was summoned back by his company, by the German company.
So he was not there for the entire time. One of the incidents that really troubled Minnie Votren was that the Japanese came and demanded prostitutes.
Yes, yes. And this was recorded in her diary in December 24th, 1937. She mentioned it and then she would mention it again.
How many did the Japanese take?
They took away 21. Or initially, they demanded 100. And then Minnie Watson gave them the permission on condition that the women would agree to do the work. But the truth was, there was no way to decide who was a prostitute. So I think she was troubled. In fact, she didn't say this, but when I was reading the diary very carefully, and I found that she took to her bed immediately after that. The next day, she was ill. And so so to my mind, she was really troubled, very, very troubled by this.
Did any of the women return?
And that part, there was no written record, but there was a mad woman who reappeared. This was recorded in her diary as well. And the woman claimed that she belonged to the college, but nobody could tell who she was.
And she claimed that she had been one of the ones who had been prostituted?
No, she didn't claim that. She just claimed that she belonged to the college.
I see.
She was insane at the time. She was demanded, and she just insisted that she was from that college. But apparently, she was a refugee. Nobody could decide who she really was.
Did they take her in?
I think yes, yes. And at the time, basically, they had to take everybody. Because people lost their homes and there were nowhere to go, especially for women and kids. And that camp, I think, let me repeat this, that camp was only for women and kids. So as a result, they have to keep it open constantly.
All right. Let's take a call from Arlington, Virginia. Good morning, Ethan.
Hi. Good morning, Diane.
Good morning.
Your show. And Hajing, I really appreciate your books. And War Trash is one of my favorite books.
Thank you.
I went to graduate school at the University of Illinois, and I worked with Iris Chang's mother, Ying Ying.
Uh-huh.
So I got to know Iris a very little bit. And my question is, while she was doing the rape of Nanking, she received, you know, a lot of pressure from the Japanese. And I was wondering if you have experienced the same thing.
Not a lot, but of course I got bad reviews. Some reviews would say the book basically didn't have a single good bone in it. Sure, and there that was kind of expected. But you know, this is at the very beginning stage, so I can't tell.
But will the book be translated into Chinese?
The Chinese edition was out, in fact, even before the English.
And what about to Japanese?
I I don't know. And I really don't know. They had published four of my books. I hope this book can
the
be
Japanese
translated. Yes, but I don't know about this one.
Yeah. What was Iris's mother like, Ethan?
Oh, she was a really sweet person. She was a very hard worker, and you know she loved her daughter very much. She was a very strict mom, but you know she used to tell us stories about. You know, she was in China. She was very young during the war, but you know, she used to tell us stories. You know about, you know, the bombings and things like that.
Yeah.
And to this day, as far as I know, she will not buy a Japanese car.
I know. I understand that. And in fact, Iris Chan, she was really a big hero to Chinese. A lot of, especially to the citizens of Nanjing, she's a household name. There was a statue, her bronze statue, at the Holocaust Museum there.
All right. Thanks for calling, Ethan. To William, who's in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Good morning, sir.
Thanks very much, Diane. It's a pleasure to be on your show today.
Thank you.
I wanted to ask your guest a question. I'm a descendant of a general that was in the Nationalist Army named Tung En Bao. And I was just curious if you had any information about whether General Tung was involved in either the planning or defense of Nanjing before the massacre.
Was the general's name Tung?
Tung En Bao.
Tung En Bao. I think he was involved, but I didn't go. I don't remember a lot, but I think he was involved. Yes, there were a lot of hundreds of generals, I think, involved in this the defense work.
Yes. Thank you very much.
All right, sir. Thanks for calling. And to Hanover, New Hampshire. Good morning, Roland.
Oh, yes. A pleasure to be here. I want to say that I teach Chinese history, so this is a subject of great interest to me. I met Iris Zhang at a wonderful conference that was held by students at Princeton University. I think it was in the late 90s.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the first international conference on the Nanjing massacre.
Yeah.
And they invited Japanese to come, as well as, of course, Americans and so on. But only one Japanese professor was willing to come, and he was considered rather a fringe person, somewhat liberal.
Yeah.
But when he actually gave his talk, he had a very low number of victims, and this seems to be a part of the huge debate in Japan is about, you know, what can we really be held accountable for? And most people, you know, dismiss it. And, you know, it's not taught in Japan, so it's a huge problem. But he gave a very low number, and because it was near New York, a lot of Chinese Americans and Chinese immigrants and so on came to the conference, and when he said that he thought only about, I think he said about 60,000 could be proven to have been killed, you know, by documents. They, of course, he was roundly booed. Can I make a comment about Iris Zhang?
Sure.
Well, I thought she was absolutely fabulous. She gave by far the most impassioned, powerful speeches. There must have been 20, 30 speakers, and she was just amazing. I was quite struck with her passion. She said that the reason she took it up is because her parents had talked about it so much, and she felt obligated to look into it.
Sure. And in fact, really, I have been aware of the dispute over the number of victims. But really, that was not that important for me, because in one person, the intensity of pain and of all humankind can be contained in one person's body and mind. But let's face it, the Tokyo International Trial already concluded that at least 200,000 civilians were killed. So that was a fact and already established internationally. So I think that was the basis for, I wouldn't go argue about the other things. I just would say this is the bottom line we had to stay with. And also I think because I mentioned in the book, when the the National Army, when they tried to resist the Japanese advance, they opened the dike of the Yellow River. That act alone killed more than 500,000 people. So when I was working on the book, I kept thinking which one of the victims would suffer more, the flood victim or a person killed by the Japanese in Nanjing. For me, the two died, they suffered the same kind of pain. To the victims, they had the same kind of agony. So for me, it was the individual, the one person, that meant more to me.
So no wonder the Chinese would boo this man who was claiming a death toll of 60,000. But at the same time, I understand and appreciate your passion for the single individual,
single person,
no matter how he or she died. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's go now to Tampa, Florida. Good morning, Denise.
Yes, good morning, Ms. Rehm, and to your esteemed guest. I'd like to mention Gladys Aylward, who was also a Christian missionary to China at that same time. She was a parlor maid in London, and I think the person my mother most admired, she used to say, how could a little parlor maid from London ever get to China? But she did. She is credited with saving Chinese children by bringing them over the mountains at the time of the Japanese attack. And I was wondering if your guest might be able to find any more documents in China about Gladys Aylward. I have never read a book, but I suppose the Missionary Society might have published something. But this gentleman has such talent, I'm sure he might be able to present it in a more palatable form. And I did see the lady. She spoke at our old Presbyterian church in Belfast, Northern Ireland, and I saw her 2 days later in Woolworth's shop in the High Street, very near the old building established in 1770. My big regret is I did not speak to her.
I see,
the person I am today, I would have come and invited her home for tea.
I think, yes, and there are, in fact, even if the college, women's college, was American college, but there were a good number of British faculty and women professors teaching
Had
there.
You read about anyone taking these children over the mountain to save them?
Over mountain, I don't remember, but I think there were children. Children were transferred to another city by the missionaries.
All
that
right.
was clear, yes.
All right, and finally to Goshen, Indiana. Good morning, Jacob.
Yes, good morning to you. Thank you for including me, and my respect to both of you.
You're most welcome.
Yes, if I could just add an anecdotal bit. In our own family, my aunt Lenora and her siblings were sent ahead to the United States by their dad, Loyal Bartel, who was a longtime missionary born in China himself. And in 1948, the family was sent ahead to leave when the communists came in, and he then spent the rest of his life in China pretty much alone, I guess, from his family, but had the privilege of living through the rest of his life in China with his Chinese Mennonite brethren there.
Interesting.
Yes, a lot of missionaries. I think that is a very kind of amazing phenomenon. After a period of time, they become partly Chinese.
Hajin, having done so much research, having now completed this book and seen its publication, how has it affected you to have this knowledge that you did not have?
I think it's a very depressing book in a way, because I mean working through it, and it was painful, very painful. But after I finished the book, I felt I had done my best. I gave everything to the book, but still, whenever people mention something, some details in the book, and I couldn't help. Being reminded of it, because all the things were still inside in me. So that tend to get me emotional.
I do understand. Hajin and his novel is Nanjing Requiem. He is the National Book Award winning author of the book Waiting. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Diane.
And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Denise Couture, Monique Nazareth, Nikki Jex, Susan Neighbors, and Lisa Dunn. And the engineer is Toby Schreiner. AC Valdez answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org, and we're on Facebook and Twitter. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from